Well, it was 1984, and I was a junior going into my senior year of college in Burlington, North Carolina. I had gone to bed that night on July 28th alone. My boyfriend had taken me home, and I'd had a very bad headache, so he had given me some aspirin, and I fell asleep. Sometime around 3 a.m. and on the 29th, I heard a noise in the room with me. I felt something brush against my left arm, and I looked to the left side, and I noticed the top of someone's head crouched beside my mattress. I asked, "Who is that? Who's there?" And at that moment, he very quickly jumped up and jumped on top of me, straddled my body, and I screamed. He covered my mouth with a gloved hand and put a knife to the left of my throat and said, "Shut up, I'm going to kill you." During that moment, as I was trying to figure out what was happening, going through all different scenarios of what was possible, you know, a break-in, somebody just being stupid and thinking this was funny, I offered him everything I owned. I offered him my car, my credit cards, and that's when he told me he didn't want my money. And that's when I realized that I was going to be raped.
And then later on, what were the circumstances under which you were told to identify the perpetrator? Because this wasn't a scenario where it was someone you were familiar with, right?
That's correct. This was a stranger rape. I was trying very hard throughout the assault to pay attention to details about his face. In those moments when I could look at him, I would remember his eyes and his nose. I knew he was African-American. He was in his early 20s. He was very light-skinned. He had a pencil-thin mustache. His hair was short. I was looking for piercings or tattoos or scars or anything. I you know, remembered his clothing. I tried to figure out how tall he was, how much he weighed, all the things that I knew were going to be important. When I was taken to the hospital after I escaped and ran. He chased me. I landed in a neighbor's backyard in her carport. It happened to be a professor that I didn't know lived there, and they rescued me, and I was taken to the hospital and learned that he had left my apartment and assaulted a second victim within an hour. And so I very much wanted to help the police find this person. I wanted to get him off the streets because I realized that he was going to continue victimizing more women. And I gave the description to the police, and it was so clear that my memory was so good. I had not been drinking. I wasn't using drugs, and I was maintaining a 4.0 GPA at school. So I have a really crazy good memory. And so at the police department, I began to give a description and helped a police artist put together a composite sketch, which very quickly ran in the newspaper and led to a suspect. And the suspect's name was Ronald Cotton.
He was put in a lineup. Is that true?
He was put into a photographic lineup first. That occurred 3 days after the assault. And I picked his photograph out of a six-pack, as they called it. Then about a week later, I was called back down to the police station to do a physical lineup, and I picked him out again.
What were you thinking at the time? Were you sure in your own mind that he was the perpetrator?
Particularly after the photographic lineup, I was absolutely positive. I picked up the photograph, and I said, "This is him." And one of the officers said, that's a good job. You know, that's who we thought it was. If that's not confirmation, I don't know what is.
So when did it start to become apparent to you that Ronald Cotton was not the man who had raped you?
It would be 11 years later when it came back with the DNA results. And that's when they told me that not only was it not Ronald Cotton, it was a man by the name of Bobby Poole who had entered into the prison system about 90 days after Ronald went into prison. And they were both from the same town. Bobby Poole was a serial rapist. He had finally been shot when he left his last victim in April of 1985. Ronald was the one who said, "Gosh, that guy right there looks like the composite sketch," which he had kept in his locker. And so it was really Ronald who began to kind of uncover who it was. But no one believed him, of course. 11 years goes by, and a DNA test is run, and not only does it absolutely 100% exclude Ronald Cotton, but it is a dead hit on Bobby Poole.
Ronald had known that someone who came into prison after he did looked like the composite sketch, and he was right. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So when did you first communicate with Ronald Cotton after the DNA evidence showed that he was actually innocent?
Ronald came out of prison on June 30th of 1995, and it would take about 2 years before I could meet him. I was really scared. I was terrified. There was a playbook on how to do this stuff in the 80s and 90s. I didn't even know that innocent people could possibly go to prison. I just truly believe the American justice system was the best in the world, and it worked exactly the way it was designed to work, which was, you know, presumption of innocence and fair trials and jury of your peers. And there wasn't anybody talking about this stuff, and there certainly wasn't anybody talking about victims from wrongful convictions. So I truly believed that Ronald had to be angry and hate me. So I just hid and didn't do anything about it until a film came out that Ronald and I participated in separately, but it was titled What Jennifer Saw. It was all about the fallibility of eyewitness ID. And it was really after watching both of us talk that I knew I had to see him and try to apologize. Ronald immediately, without hesitation, forgave me. And it was then, in April of 97, that we both began to start healing together and, you know, realizing that we had both been victims of Bobby Poole. Bobby Poole created an incredible amount of harm, and he had hurt a lot of people, and he had done it with intent, and he had done it with malice. And that was something that Ron and I knew, you know, was the beginning of our friendship. We had that experience in common. We talked about pain and fears and loss that we had both suffered, and we became friends. There's a lot of messages that Ron and I actually talk about. You know, we talk about violence against women and what that means and what that looks like for the survivor. We talk about eyewitness issues and how prone to fallibility our brains are. We really don't understand a lot about the brain. So we talk, you know, about what causes contaminated memory and the issues involved in that and what kind of reforms we can put into place to help, we'll never completely eradicate, but to help ensure that innocent people don't go to prison and that the guilty people do. But we also talk about forgiveness and how we heal as individuals and as a collective voice, how we can heal using forgiveness.